You gotta understand something here. This music is the glue of the world. It holds it all together. Without this, life would be meaningless.
What are you getting so crazy about? It's just music.
Welcome to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. I'm Jim DeRogatis, the pop music critic at the Chicago Sun-Times.
And I'm Greg Kot. I write about rock and roll for the Chicago Tribune. Today on the world's only rock and roll talk show, a conversation with Memphis soul legend and multi-instrumentalist Booker T. Jones.
Plus, fresh from tours opening for Bob Dylan, U2, and Pearl Jam, we have a new album from the Kings of Leon, and Greg Kot will have a Desert Island Jukebox pick.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and time now for some music news.
Greg, that is a track called The Beginning of the End. It is by Trent Reznor, better known to the world at large as Nine Inch Nails, from his new album, which is more than an album. Boy, this is a very well-planned, thorough Warren of rabbit holes. It's a maze. It's a concept album sprung to life, which is coming at people from numerous media all at once. The album's called Year Zero, and it's more than an album, as I said. It's a CD booklet. It's a concept. It was a tour that preceded the release of the album. It's this grassroots marketing campaign using the web. People who saw Reznor and Nine Inch Nails on their last tour realized that there were several slogans on the T-shirt they couldn't explain. One was, "I am trying to believe." And by adding a .com to the end of that phrase, they began to find these interlocking websites that started to tell this story of this album. The album's a concept album. We're going to review it. But it's hard to talk about the marketing campaign without talking about the concept. In the year 2022, sometime in the future, there is this Orwellian universe that Reznor would like us to imagine in which things look a lot like today, except taken to extremes. We're at war with the Muslim world. Things are going badly. The government's getting panicked. As an alleged prevention to bioterrorism, they have put a chemical in the drinking water called parapin, which actually is a sort of Orwellian drug that's getting people to kind of be zombies and just follow the lockstep march. All right, we're in sci-fi territory here. We're in Weirdoville. But we're also in a very savvy, brilliant business move. One thing we've talked about in the news segment of Sound Opinions since we started the show here is how it's increasingly becoming obvious that artists have to give consumers more with the album than just the music, because they're able to download tracks off the web now. In some cases, you can get them for free without paying for them. What is in it for me? You know, what else are you giving me? Used to be you'd buy a big old gatefold double vinyl album, and you got posters and stickers and all sorts of, and a place to fold your marijuana joints, right? Reznor's trying to put some fun. And Reznor and fun are two words that don't often go together. But with this new Nine Inch Nails album, he's trying to give you this world, this universe, this story. There are tracks that are floating out there that he's giving away for free. The first one was allegedly found by a fan at a Nine Inch Nails concert on a flash drive in Lisbon, Portugal, right?
And in a bathroom stall.
In a bathroom stall, right. He's making this a lot of fun.
What you're saying, Jim, is really key, because I think what Reznor is, he's battling for his life here as a viable, relevant recording artist. He's been around since 1989. He was one of the rising stars of that alternative rock generation of the early 90s who came up with the Lollapalooza crowd, made several albums during that era which were huge sellers. He makes his albums very sporadically, very meticulously, did not return until 1999 with his third album, The Fragile. You and I both agree, one of the best albums of that era.
A great
but
record.
A commercial stiff. He went into a deep depression after that. Substance abuse took a hold of him on subsequent tours. And he made that the subject of his next record, With Teeth, which came out in 2005. Much more of a live rock sound on that record. And now suddenly, you know, 2 years later, he's back with his fifth studio record. Unusually short amount of time between
no
records
time
for
at
Reznor.
All for Reznor. Yeah,
yeah, indication that he's really energized again. And I think one of the things that energized him was exactly what you were talking about at the top of this show: giving consumers something extra beyond the music and returning to that era that he loved so much, when you did have those double gatefold sleeves and you did have these elaborately packaged records. Reznor is doing that for the new media, multimedia age, and extending this campaign beyond the confines of a mere piece of music and turning it into a multimedia event. Year Zero is the name. Let's play a track from it and then give it a review. Capital G from Nine Inch Nails, Year Zero on Sound Opinion.
I pushed a button and elected him to office, and he pushed a button and it dropped a bomb. You pushed a button and can watch it on the television. Those words of us didn't last too long. I'm sick of hearing about the haves and the have-nots. Have some personal accountability. The biggest problem with the way that we've been doing things is the more we let you have, the less that I'll be keeping for me. I used to stand for something. Now I'm on my hands and knees, draining my gun for this one who sends his name with the capital G.
We used to stand for something, but we've got nothing to be. Some key lines from Capital G, one of the key tracks on Year Zero, new album from Nine Inch Nails. Trent Reznor doing this record essentially on a laptop computer, whereas the previous record had some live drummers on it and some organic guitar, bass, drum sound on it. The template for this record, you know, there's noises as important as melody. You have these beats, blips, grinding noises, trash compactors. Yeah. You know, instead of guitar solos, you get what literally sounds like a piece of metal being fed into a garbage disposal. I mean,
yeah,
it is really an extreme record. At the same time, Reznor's singing is very nuanced. I think there's some beautiful moments on this record where he drops his voice to barely above a whisper, and he's talking essentially, I think this is a record that, you know, talk about the concept, people are still trying to figure it out, as we were talking about through all these multimedia things that he's doing online. I think this is a chronicle of the last days of Earth, basically. I mean, it ends with him watching the Earth rotate around the sun for the last time.
Well, Year Zero being today,
yeah,
and we are on this path, and unless we get off this path as he sees it, the end is coming. Look, there's two things here. You know, one, yeah, the lyrics can seem a little silly at times, but he is very effectively creating a universe, no less so than Roger Waters did with The Wall.
Sure.
You know, you were going to buy into this guy losing his mind on stage and becoming this messianic rock star, or you weren't. You're going to buy into this vision of George Bush leading us to an Orwellian future, or you're not. And I don't know, it's a lot easier to buy this, I think, sometimes than The Wall's concept or Tommy's. It's really an ambitious record. And just as much musically, Greg, like you said, this guy is a sonic architect.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. Not only, you know, there's never anything that is clearly bass, drums, and guitar and keyboard. You know, he is inventing instruments, basically building his own orchestra. Sometimes they're very familiar sounding. There's a beautiful moment where it drops down to what sounds like somebody playing an African thumb piano.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful record because he never skimps on the melodies. And so you have this incredible sonic stuff happening, assaulting you at all times. This is a record people are going to be listening to for years, trying to figure out how he built this sound. And I think on the buy it, burn it, trash it Sound Opinion scale, wow, Trent Reznor is an alternative survivor who came back and gave us a masterpiece.
Yeah.
It's a buy it record.
Yeah, the vocal melodies over those noisescapes, really inventive, telling the record from multiple perspectives. And you made the point earlier about Pink Floyd and The Wall. I draw it back to those classic, really ambitious records from those era, from that era. Pink Floyd's The Wall, The Who's Quadrophenia. I think it's in that range in terms of its ambition.
Well, yeah, he's breaking new ground, and
absolutely.
The marketing fun is part of it. I mean, the fact that you can dig and dig and dig,
yeah.
And you know, you're going to find hidden videos on the web.
Mm-hmm.
You're
going
to find websites devoted to conversations, and people are making themselves part of the story. You know, we've been talking for a long time about the possibility of being able to interact with a piece of rock art that you really love. With this, Reznor is trying to invite people to continue the story and become part, and maybe that'll even include people adding new tracks about some of these characters and stuff.
Yeah, once the record comes out, this is not over. This is going to go on for at least another year, it seems like, where clues are going to be divulged and pieces of the story are going to come together. So it really is, I think, a new plateau in terms of presenting a piece of music in a really inventive way. And I agree with you. It's a buy. I buy the album and I buy the concept. I mean, you know, just keep going with this thing because I think it's really exciting. That is Green Onions from Booker T and the MGs. How's that for an intro into music? Booker T. Jones, a nobody in a Memphis recording studio in the early 60s, and that is his debut record. It goes on to sell a million copies. His career is off and running. Booker T. Jones goes on to work with people like Otis Redding, Sam and Dave, Albert King, Wilson Pickett, goes on to produce Willie Nelson and Bill Withers on some of their most remarkable albums. What a career he's had. Jim, we were privileged on the 50th anniversary of Stax Records, the famous Memphis soul label, to interview Booker T at the South by Southwest Music Conference. Booker T was in town to perform, and we're very happy to be able to interview him as well.
Now, people know the other MGs. They know Duck Dunn and Steve Cropper. They give a lot of interviews. Booker T doesn't talk that often.
No.
So we were lucky to be sitting there with him. I started the conversation not with that organ. The organ that he played on Green Onions is actually in the Stax Museum of American Soul Music. It's a point of pride to Booker that he never stopped his musical education and that he is a multi-instrumentalist. His first instruments were oboe, saxophone, tuba, piano, guitar. It was only later this organ thing came. So that's where we started talking to him.
Most of the instruments I learned by necessity as a 10-year-old fourth grader whose first instrument was clarinet at a little less than 5 feet tall. I was too small, too young, too short to get into the school band. And the blank chair, the empty chair, was oboe.
Mm.
So I learned to play the oboe, and I learned how to make the reeds, and I learned how to play the solos, and I got into the band that way.
A child prodigy, I guess is the way to describe it. Booker, I'm going to quote you from your own very own website. You're talking about music, the power of music. These sounds and sentiments on vinyl, 8-track, and MP3 are the threads that human souls balance so many of their emotions on. Almost all of our passages, weddings, funerals, loves, hates, are experienced with music as a backdrop. We soar to heights and fall to depths unmeasured with music as a backdrop. Very eloquent. The question is, what was your first series of musical moments that sort of where you realized the power of this thing and kind of realized that this is going to be your life?
I had a dynamic musical mother. I think her influence on me was immeasurable because she had such a wonderful, deep, wide musical soul. So maybe then I realized I too would just hopefully have music in my life all my life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Your parents were educated people. Your dad was an educator. Your mom, obviously, an accomplished musician. Mm-hmm. And yet you're running out of the house as a kid, you know, 12, 13, 14 years old, jamming with Willie Mitchell in the Memphis clubs.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Mom and Dad thought that was okay?
They had incredible faith in me and trust, and they supported me. I was fortunate. Most parents wouldn't have done that. My father took me to the clubs and waited for me outside or had friends to come and get me.
Wow.
And drove the bands to clubs in Arkansas and Mississippi with, and stayed while we played and brought us back home. I was extremely fortunate to have a father who did that.
That's the great untold story of rock and roll. I remember talking to Joey Ramone's mother about driving the boys in the station wagon to CBGB. It's the parents who waited outside the gig. That's the story, right,
yeah,
Booker?
That's right, yeah.
So you were talking about your first session a little earlier in the green room. Tell us about that.
I was still in high school, and Ahmet Erdogan had called my sister to get me to come and play on a Bobby Darin session in Hollywood. My sister drove me to Sunset Boulevard, and there it all was, all laid out with music. Everybody was in one room, the Blossoms, Jerry Wexler, Bobby Darin. There we were, recording.
But that was the first time you were out of Memphis, probably, even, right?
Yes, I think it was, yeah.
It's a good trip.
Yeah,
yeah. I was going to say.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
My first trip outside of town was not... not at a session like that. So were you nervous? I mean, was that something that were you? What am I doing here? Do I belong here?
Yeah, I was wondering if they'd made a mistake. I was wondering. Yeah.
We want to take you through your career chronologically. Touch on all the stuff. Obviously, Stax is a part of that. There's a lot of Stax in the air this week at South by Southwest 50th anniversary. I got a real basic question. How did it come to be Booker T and the MGs?
I think it became Booker T and the MGs because it was just such an odd occurrence that day. We had showed up. It was a recording session. We were the staff band for a guy that didn't show up, and we just happened to record a blues that Jim Stewart, the engineer, liked, and he decided, oh, well, we have a record here. And then they said, well, you know, we need something for the B-side of it. Do you guys have something for that? And so then we recorded what became Green Onions for the B-side of it. None of it was meant to be. I mean, and we didn't know that this ever was going to go forward into the future. So it became Booker T and the MGs because Al Jackson said, okay, well, you know, what are we going to call the band? He said, well, Booker T and the looked outside the window, and Chips Moman had a little MG car parked out on the street there. Booker T and the MGs. And I mean, it was all just a little bit more than a joke.
Yeah.
I mean, you're very casual about it. And in a lot of ways, even as a young man, it seemed like you had ambitions and you had plans. I mean, you were going to college at the same time. You just recorded Green Onions, and then you made the 8-hour drive back to college, as I recall, right? within a couple of days.
Green Onions happened just before I graduated from high school, and college was in my plan before we made the record. And the record fit in well with my college plans because I had no money to go to college. So, yeah.
There must have been a ton of pressure. I mean, Green Onions sold 750,000 copies, was a huge hit, really put Stax on the map. Mm-hmm. And you're the house band. They probably wanted you in there 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, cranking out hits, and said, no, I'm going to college.
Yeah, I was pretty stubborn about it, and it became a point of contention a number of times, yeah.
I've got a philosophical question, Booker, about those Stax years. In the rock encyclopedias, in the history books, you are one of the greatest sidemen in the history of the music. What about that word?
Well, I've got a lot of pleasure from being a sideman and a songwriter for other people. I mean, I've learned a lot, and I've benefited in many ways from doing that. I still do that. I think it elevates me to be a sideman in a lot of situations.
Mm-hmm. So it's not something you've ever you've taken it with pride.
Yeah, and I think if I were only solo all this time, it might have been quite a bit more narrow. I've been exposed to different types of music and. And I think my career would have been a lot more restricted.
Booker T. Jones, once again in his role as a sideman. Man, what a sideman he was. Not only the Hammond organ, but on that track playing the tuba for Soul Man by Sam and Dave. Guy could do everything. When we come back on Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media, we're going to have more with Booker T. Jones, including his work with Neil Young and that amazing night with Otis Redding at the Monterey Pop Festival in 1967.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. You're listening to a little bit of Hip Hugger, one of many examples of the great Stax soul sound that our guest Booker T. Jones helped to create. We asked him about this in an interview taped before a live studio audience at South by Southwest.
Jim and I, as music critics, want to thank you, Booker. It's long overdue, because Stax Volt, the Stax sound, it's critical journalistic shorthand. We don't have to explain a whole lot. We just say, oh, it's the Stax sound. And there's maybe, like, you can count on the fingers of two hands at most, maybe defining sounds of the last, you know, half century. Yours was one of them. You were integral to that. There was maybe 5-6 key people in that sound. And then there's a lot of debate about what made that sound. We actually had Duck Dunn on the show a couple of years ago, and we were talking about, well, I never changed my bass strings. That was kind of that was one of the keys to the sound, you know. Just those were that dirty sound. I just wanted to keep it dirty and gritty.
And they were dirty.
Yeah, and Al Jackson too. You helped bring Al to Stax. You'd been playing with him in the Memphis clubs. But what was your take on it? What made that sound what it was?
Well, hearing you mention Al, it makes me realize that a lot of the Stax sound did come and originate from him and his own refusal to allow the beat to be too not well defined. Is insistent that we have this attitude that, and maybe that became infectious. Maybe that kind of infected everybody. That we have this attitude that this music is just going to be pushing some kind of limit. Most of the songs that came out of Stax have that feeling of, oh my goodness, listen to that.
Obviously, you were hearing what was going on in popular culture and music at the time, the Motown thing, and a lot of was made Stax versus Motown, you know? And a lot of people said, you guys were the true soul thing. You had the true grit. I mean, did you see it that way in terms of North versus South in terms of that sound?
No, it wasn't versus. We listened to their records because we loved them, but we weren't in competition with them. But we weren't making music that was as laid back as theirs in any case. But no, we didn't see them as adversaries at all. No.
What happened on that European tour in the spring of 67?
Yeah.
Those tempos were unbelievable. That was punk rock, man.
Yeah.
You guys were doing speed.
What happened on that tour?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I spent a lot of energy trying to figure out what was going on. There was something going on between Otis Redding and Al Jackson. You know, they were both possessed people. And sometimes they were at odds, but yeah, the tempos were up there, and yeah, I mean, the people loved it, and that tour had a special energy. Shake with the feeling. Listen while I talk to you tonight. Tell you what I'm gonna do tonight. Got some new things going around there. I'll tell you what, putting it down. You move your body all around, and just shake. All gone, gone, baby, now.
What was Monterey Pop like?
Monterey Pop was probably my second real big eye-opening experience, personally, because I landed back in the United States and saw something I would never have ever guessed I would have seen here. It was just an amazing... The police had relinquished the city to the Hell's Angels. Oh, no, this is true. Our escorts into the festival were Hell's Angels motorcycle guys who were making sure that we didn't, you know, get stopped on the street or whatever.
Yeah, and things went a lot better there than they would at Altamont a couple of years later.
Well, I guess so, yeah. Yeah.
This is the love crowd, right? We all love each other, don't we? Am I right? I've been loving you too to stop now.
I think that as music lovers, we tend to glamorize these things, the concert you did at Madison Square Garden for Dylan or Monterey Pop. But are they really different when you're on stage and you look out? I mean, were you sitting there playing at Monterey Pop thinking, you know, this is what I'm going to remember as opposed to what I did on Tuesday night?
In that sense, it's not glamorized at all, because it was just an unbelievable experience for all of us on stage, looking at the audience and playing the music and the things that happened before the concert, the conversations in the dressing room, the people that you met in the dressing room, the whole experience was just surreal and so different from everyday life. It was a life-changing experience for me and probably for a lot of people. It was a confirmation that people's hearts can change, and it was a confirmation of a lot of things that people were trying to get going in the 60s and had no success with. It was an affirmation that people could really care about each other and cooperate. It was crazy.
This is Sound Opinions. You're listening to a discussion by Greg Kot and myself with Booker T. Jones at the South by Southwest Music Festival. One of the threads throughout Booker's career is that he constantly challenged himself to try new things. In 1969, Booker T and the MGs branched out and did their rendition of Abbey Road, which we're hearing underneath. Then, in 1970, Booker left Stax and a steady stream of jobs to go to California and expand his sound, worked also as a producer. It just so happened that his new neighbor, downstairs neighbor, would be somebody he'd get to produce, one Willie Nelson. We asked Booker about what it was like to work with Willie.
That was great, because we were in new territory and we both loved it, and we were doing songs that we loved, old songs, great old songs that he had done them for years in clubs, and so had I, and so it was a reunion in a way to get to do to record those songs. So we just had a great time doing that.
That was the Stardust record in 77.
Yeah.
I mean, here you have possibly the biggest country artist of that era. Mm-hmm. Had a string of hits with the so-called outlaw country sound. Mm-hmm. So he was pushing the envelope.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you yourself had a history in R&B. A lot of people knew you primarily through those Stax records at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And you make this record of standards,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
that had been out of the lexicon of pop culture for at least a couple of decades.
Mm-hmm.
How did you guys, first of all, you must have drove the record company guys nuts proposing something like that. And then secondly, how did you guys hatch that idea in the first place?
Well, Willie's a magician. You know, those were the songs that we were jamming on. And I say he's a magician because he didn't impose this on the record company. He's just like, well, hey, we really need to go in the studio and do this, you know. And so he got a friend, Brian Ahern, who had a truck, and another friend, Emmylou Harris, who had a house in Beverly Hills, and we went into her house to do the recording and move the mics and everything inside the house, and the truck was in the driveway, and we just did it. I mean, and Columbia, you know, they were pretty much on his side, and they weren't sure, but when we played the album for them, they really liked it. They didn't know if the public would like it, but they liked it, so they printed a few copies, and that was all we really needed.
Georgia, Georgia, no peace I find. Just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind. Just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
You've never wanted to be boxed in. Don't label me. You know, it's like, yes, you're labeled the organist sideman of all time, but a lot of the stuff you contributed to records you played on was guitar.
Yeah.
And as producer, you know, working with Rita Coolidge, was your wife's sister, right?
Mm-hmm.
Working with Bill Withers.
My then wife.
Then wife, yes. Bill Withers. Willie Nelson, later on Neil Young. Mm-hmm. That's a really diverse list of people who I've worked with.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few resumes that are that all over the map.
Yeah, that's, you know, it's the spice in my life, that diversity. I love it, you know, it's...
You know, Jim brought up Bill Withers in Ain't No Sunshine.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. It's not warm when she's away. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. And she's always gone too long. Anytime she goes away.
And really, you talk about a sound. You had the Stax sound. I think there was a Bill Withers sound that was incredibly influential that you helped build. Because this guy was this gifted songwriter who really didn't have a career. I mean, he didn't think his songs would ever be recorded by anyone. Mm-hmm. I think he was like building airplane toilets in a factory or something.
Yeah, he was working
like
in Inglewood. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So he comes to you, and you end up producing his first record, which becomes a huge hit. And I think there was an anecdote that I heard, and tell me if this is correct. Withers goes, well, okay, you're assembling this band for him, and he goes, well, who's going to sing the songs?
Yeah, that was one of the amazing times in my career. I'll never forget it. We were standing there in the control room. Everyone was there. Everything was set. And Bill just kind of stopped and said, Booker, who's going to sing this? There's only one other person. I said, you are. You are, Bill. And then he went out and he sang.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. It's his house, just ain't no home. Anytime she goes away. Anytime she goes away.
Well, let's ask you about Neil Young. You produced a record with him and got to tour with him.
Uh-huh. Neil is this intense personality, and music is just his entire being. But we met on the Bob Dylan show, and we ended up playing on one of the songs for the Bob Dylan tribute. He's a great friend also. There's just so many parts to Neil that I don't know where to start.
Well, he wanted to go in that album in a soul direction, but, you know, Neil never wants to do anything simple. So he kept San Pedro around to play the guitar because he wanted to still have some of the grungy, crazy horse rock.
Okay.
You're talking about Are You Passionate? That
right. Are You Passionate is the record. How does something like that begin? Does Neil sit down and say, I've got this idea, Booker. I want you to help me get it. Or is it so much more organic than that? Do you just wind up going up to his ranch and playing?
Well, both. You know, that's... Both.
Yeah.
And each song began in a different way. He's completely open-minded, so every song began in a different way, sometimes on acoustic guitar, and the instruments were just amazing, sometimes marimbas or people. He's open to just amazing, all the ideas, you know, for people to come in and sing or not. He has tape running all the time. He's got cameras rolling all the time. I mean, it's just...
You had brought up, you'd met Neil Young at the Bob Dylan 30th anniversary concert in the early 90s at Madison Square Garden. I actually covered that show. There was this incredible array of artists there. Mm-hmm. As I recall, were you not backing up most of the musicians on stage that night?
Yeah, I think we played behind almost everybody.
Yeah, which is a huge task. You had to learn all that music.
Yeah.
You know, days of rehearsals. Was there any challenge more daunting than the others in terms of, okay, how are we going to do this? How are we going to back up this particular artist?
Mm-hmm. These interviews are always kind of self-incriminating because you're asked to tell the truth about people, you know. Yes, you know, there were, I had a hard time with Eric Clapton, but we came up with some beautiful music.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What was it about Clapton? Was it just the song, the melody, the...
He did something you would never guess he would do. He walked into the studio and he said, you know, he didn't know how he wanted to do the song. You would never guess that from Eric Clapton, because he's a huge star. You would never. I didn't say any of that.
That part's off the record.
This is a man who liked to be prepared, so I can see where you'd be.
Professionalism.
Yes. Yeah.
Seems like you can deal with any kind
respect.
Of genre, any kind
let,
of quirk.
Let me stop now. I'm going to fix that. I have the utmost respect for Eric Clapton. I love everything he's ever done. I love the Cream. I love Ginger Baker. I love everything he ever touched. Okay.
But when you work with people, you want them to come in and you want them to be ready to go.
No,
right?
I didn't want that. I didn't. I just didn't expect it.
What do you look for, Booker, for people you're going to make music with in 2007?
Sinead O'Connor.
You look for Sinead?
Wasn't that a hell of an answer? She's no, I don't look for Sinead O'Connor.
That night at
well, that was going to be my next question about that.
That night at the Garden. Yeah. Did that blow your mind?
Absolutely.
Well, Neil Young, I happened to interview him the next day, and he was the artist that went on stage after Sinead had her moment, where she basically, for those of you who don't know, Sinead O'Connor had just ripped up the picture of the Pope on Saturday Night Live, I think like a week or two before this concert. And she went on stage to sing, and basically, I think she started to sing, but you couldn't tell because the booing was so loud, and people were just drowned her out. And she broke down in tears, and Kris Kristofferson finally helped lead her off the stage, and it was a meltdown moment. You know, you could literally see an artist's career sort of, there it was, you know, the moment where your artist's career is never the same again. So Neil Young was the artist that followed her on stage. And I asked Neil, what was that like? Did you have any empathy for her? Did you feel like you needed to say something to that audience? And he says, no, I'm not there to review the audience. I'm there to do my thing, you know? And people get booed all the time and basically...
Good answer.
Tough, you know?
Good answer. Where were you? Your perspective is interesting because I was on stage. Where were you?
I was actually kind of above the stage on the side. So I was probably in the third balcony looking down on right on the side of the stage.
So you couldn't see or hear everything?
No.
Okay.
Some frightening stuff?
Yeah, no.
What were you hearing that was?
Well, she never started to sing.
I'm trying to remember exactly what she did.
She did nothing.
She stood up there and got nailed, right? So what you're saying is maybe she should have started the performance and...
I don't know.
But needless to say, that's something you hadn't experienced. I mean, it's interesting.
It was a first.
That's another one that goes on the list.
Yeah.
That was a first.
All right, let me try this again. Moving forward, making new music today,
mm-hmm.
What you play with a lot of people. You just played with the Drive-By Truckers the other night.
Yeah, that was fun. Yeah.
But when you're recording now, what are you going to look for in people that you want to make a record with?
I'm going to look for that special thing that I've found in the past, and I'm finding it in people. That special thing, you know, the special thing that I found in Steve Cropper and Al Jackson, you know, that's in new people too, and I'm finding it, and I'm very gratified and very happy with. I'm very excited about my future, my musical future. Yeah.
Coming up on Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media, we're going to review an album by modern-day Southern rockers Kings of Leon, and Greg Kot will have a Desert Island Jukebox pick.
hanging off in a coupe de ville. She's buckled up on Navy. She don't care what her mama said. No, she's gonna have my baby. Taking all I have to take. This taking's gonna shave me.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. That is the Kings of Leon from their new record, Because of the Times. Indelicately titled opening track, Knocked Up. Guess what that's about?
She's going to have his baby.
Yeah. 7 minutes of running away. They're going to have that baby no matter what. Third album from Kings of Leon, a Nashville quartet. Three brothers and a cousin, the Followill brothers. They are the sons of a Southern Pentecostal preacher. Came out with their debut album in 2003 when many of them were still in their teens. Signed to the Strokes record label RCA and got noticed because they went out on tour. Kings of Leon sort of following along in their coattails a bit and getting noticed with a sound that had been compared, I think, wrongly to the Strokes, much more influenced by 70s Southern rock. In fact, they owe much more to Lynyrd Skynyrd than they do to the Strokes. They're now on album number 3, the more mature third record, because of the times. Yeah, they've grown up a little bit. They've kind of developed their sound. They're taking some more chances. We're going to get to the review in a minute, but let's play a track from the new Kings of Leon record. It's called McFearless on Sound Opinions.
That's a track called McFearless from the third album by Kings of Leon, Because of the Times. Greg, I loathe this album with a bile I reserve for very special occasions, and I'll tell you why. Kings of Leon, on their first two records, were essentially a garage rock take or a slightly hipper take on the Black Crowes, playing that southern classic rock of the 70s with a little bit of an underground alternative garage rock, indie, whatever attitude you want to say, okay? It wasn't great. It was good in small doses. Then they started to get heavily hyped by RCA Records. They went out on tour, opening in arenas, enormodomes, megadomes for Bob Dylan, for Pearl Jam, and worst of all, for U2. What you can hear in McFearless, they have rejiggered the guitar sound of this band throughout this album to have that heavy, echo-drenched, reverb-laden, chorused, cliched U2 guitar sound that The Edge was doing circa the Joshua Tree long time ago. Even The Edge doesn't sound like that Edge anymore. These guys are trying to sound like that Edge. I've seen some interviews where they've been talking about, we played these arenas and we would play when people were still filing in with their hot dogs and just getting there, parking the car, and you know, we loved the way that music would sound in these big open expanses. Look, kids, that's not how rock and roll is ever supposed to sound. You know, arenas are a bad place to see music, period. But then to be like the opening band playing to the empty arena and to think that's what you should sound like on this record, when you have a track like what we came in with, Knocked Up, and, you know, he wants her to have his baby, and he's ticking mom off, and it's, you know, it's retro, it's sexist, it's stupid, mostly. And it's 7 minutes long. Even the tracks like McFearless that are 4 minutes long seem to be about 12 minutes long. If you're Neil Young and Crazy Horse, one of the bands that Kings of Leon used to worship, you'd get away with that because the guitars and the hypnotic rhythm section delivered the goods, right? You can just sing, "Down by the river, I shot my baby." You can sing that for 12 minutes if you're Neil Young and get away with it. You can't if you're Caleb Followell. Not when your guitars suck, when you have no melodies, you have nothing to say. And I mean, this is a bad, bad, bad record. It is a trash it record on our scale.
I love that they tick you off so much. That makes me like this record even more. Because I think that one of the things about these guys that ticks people off is that they are, in fact, Southern, and unapologetically Southern. That's why I so loathed those comparisons they were getting to the Strokes 3 or 4 years ago. Oh, they're cool because they sort of sound like these New York bands, and they kind of got this garage rock sound, which was kind of hip at the time. No, they didn't want any part of that. To my mind, this is a sloppy Southern rock band to its core. They are not super smart guys. This guy's slurry, blurry vocals. I mean, I'm kind of glad I don't know exactly what he's singing about. You know, it's nasty stuff. I don't really want to know all the details. But I love their approach in concert. I love the guitar sound that you loathe so much. I think it's big, it's nasty,
You're
it's
buying
meaty.
This edge. That's not big and nasty. It's heavily echoed. It's silly.
There's some
it's
of that.
Silly.
There's some of that on this record.
There's tons of it on that.
But there's also a lot of blues inflections. There's not, you know, blues is such a loathed art form these days. It's anybody who plays any blues licks is immediately looked upon as retro and out of
date.
Well,
if you're Johnny Lang, yeah.
And these guys are retro and kind of out of date, and they unapologetically so. I think they're way better than the Black Crowes, who are a band that has gotten into this jam mode that is really despicable.
Well, that's where these guys do write
songs, you know? They do stomp those boot heels down, and they do crank up those guitars. It's a nice, messy sound. They would have been perfect as the band in Cameron Crowe's Almost Famous. They should have been Stillwater.
That's an insult to my friend Cameron Crowe. And I have nothing against the South. Some of my best friends are Southern. I'm saying this band sucks because they're doing bad imitation U2 circa the third album, War. And that's why they suck, okay?
I don't think they're imitating anybody other than these out-of-fashion heroes from Southern rock in the 70s.
What about Charmer, which is a blatant Pixies ripoff, note for note.
I don't buy that either.
Rhythm, guitar for guitar. Frank Black Yelp for Frank Black Yelp. It's a...
Oh, you know...
Come on, listen to that song.
I don't understand the Pixies comparison at all on that track.
You haven't listened to the track.
I've listened to the Pixies. I've listened to this band. There's no comparison. There are different bands. These guys sound like their own thing. I don't think they made a great beginning to end record, but this is a burn it record for me, and I think they have their charms as a live band.
I'm sorry. You're nuts. I'm trashing it, and I'm sticking with it.
I tell you, little buddy, this whole island is bewitched.
You remember, we were shipwrecked together.
Every week here on Sound Opinions, Greg or I takes a turn and pops a quarter in the Desert Island Jukebox. Mr. Cott, your pick.
Jim, we have just debated the merits of Southern rock or the demerits of Southern rock, and I would like to extend the conversation further with the DIJ and pay tribute to one of my favorite bands and one of the most misunderstood bands of all time.
Molly Hatchet?
No, Molly Hatchet, I think we understand them all too well.
All right.
Lynyrd Skynyrd, on the other hand, I do not think gets the credit it deserves, however. Probably known best for two things. Freebird. That's three things. The fourth thing being that they went down in a plane crash in 1977 in which lead singer Ronnie Van Zant and two other band members were killed. They've since resurrected themselves in various incarnations over the years, but really it's never been the same since lead singer Ronnie Van Zant went down, and with good reason. Ronnie Van Zant, I think, was in many ways the best of the Southern rock vocalists in that he sort of broke the formula. He broke the mold. When you think about Southern rock vocalists, you think about somebody like Greg Allman, a guy really steeped in the blues. Ronnie Van Zant was much more subtle, much more of an insinuating vocalist, much more slippery, much more sly than any other Southern rock vocalist, and I don't think he gets enough credit for that. They think about Lynyrd Skynyrd, and you think about Confederate flags and gun racks, you know? Ronnie sort of played up to that stereotype in a way by showing up barefoot on stage wearing these ankle-length duster coats and a cowboy hat.
But these guys would also play parties at Phil Walden, their record company executive's estate, where a young governor named Jimmy Carter would be there. So, you know, there was an enlightened South being born at the same time. You're right.
Exactly. There was an enlightened aspect to the art and the songwriting. Simple Man, Tuesday's Gone. These songs show a sort of a higher consciousness about a lot of issues. Great example of it is the song I'm going to play, Saturday Night Special. These guns, these cheap handguns, were rampant in the South at the time, killing a lot of people that Ronnie Van Zant knew. The combination of whiskey and a Saturday Night Special was just absolutely lethal. But he wrote a very eloquent song, and one of the nastiest songs in the Lynyrd Skynyrd canon. And what I love about the song is that he just sort of tells a tale. And, you know, at the end, you can sort of see him, you know, for $20, you can buy one, too. You know, the way he would just sort of slyly slip these little lines in there and make you realize, you know, how stupid can you be to buy one of these things and have it in your home or have it in your car? A really underrated vocalist, an underrated band. Here's Saturday Night Special from Lynyrd Skynyrd. Saturday Night Special from Lynyrd Skynyrd, 1975 album Nothing Fancy, my Desert Island Jukebox pick for this week. Next week, Jim, we have Joe Boyd, one of the key behind-the-scenes figures in music for the last 30, 40 years. He discovered people like Pink Floyd, Fairport Convention, Nick Drake, and he's going to tell us how he did it next week.
Got some thank yous to say on the way out. Andy Flynn at South by Southwest hooked us up with Booker T. Jones. It was a real treat to do that down there. As always, Sound Opinions is produced by Todd Bachman, Matt Spiegel, Jason Saldana, and Robin Lynn. And our fearless leader is Tori Southside Malatia, who was to have been the fifth MG, but something happened.
Lynyrd Skynyrd asked him to replace Ronnie Van Zant.
Man.
And, you know, he turned that job down,
He
too.
Gets around. He needs to make better career choices, though.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So give us a call on our hotline, 1-888-859-1800.
Come on and answer your phone. Answer your phone. Pick up the receiver. I know that you're at home.
New messages.
Hey, my name is Mike Miller. I'm calling from San Francisco, and I've recently discovered the podcast, and I'm a huge, huge fan. I wanted to thank you so much for the Elephant Six show. Also, I wanted to thank you guys and Jason Lytle for introducing me to Midlake a little ways back. downloaded hours and hours and hours of your show, and one of the most entertaining things I've ever heard on the radio show was Jim going off on Bruce Springsteen, and I completely agree. It was incredibly entertaining, but you gotta let Greg talk too, you know. So as long as you let him talk, yeah, please let the world know how awful Bruce Springsteen is, because I'm right there with you on that one. Anyway, thanks for a great show. I look forward to it every week. Take care.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, no, no, no. I ain't got the time, and if my daddy thinks I'm fine, they tried to make me go to rehab. I won't go, go, go.
Hello, this is Rose. Greetings from Omaha. I just have to let you know that your comments about that gin-soaked poser Amy Winehouse were spot on. I don't understand the brouhaha about her. I think she's a marginal talent, and she's got so much affected substance, and her style is just going nowhere as far as I'm concerned. It's an interesting juxtaposition, you know, when you have a real talent like Nico Case, who came across as very engaging and very funny and very refreshing. Says a lot about music in our time that you can have someone as hyped up as Winehouse and someone like Nico Case, who not a lot of people are familiar with, but fortunately we have your show to put people straight, and keep up the good work. Thank you.
My name's John Haskell from Chicago, and while I appreciate that Count Basie would recognize his name, it's surely Bassie, as in the fish. I think she would probably appreciate that pronunciation anyway. Thanks.
Hey, this is Ron from Chicago. Loved your spot on Portishead. Trip-hop was a genre that came and went way too fast. One of my favorites, which sort of had the same career track, Sneaker Pimps. Terrible band name, but great first album. Beautiful, you know, vocals, and very lovely and trippy. But the good work. Bye.
Hi, this is Ed Hodder from Berea, Ohio. You know, a good mocking can ruin a piece of music forever. My wife hasn't listened to Al Stewart in almost 20 years now, so it can be a force for good. During your review of the December's The Crane Wife, one of you delivered a classic mock to the song The Island. I still have this record in rotation, and I still hear you every time that part in the song comes up. La. But I love the music, and I think it takes a special piece of music to overcome a really good mocking, but the Decemberists did it. Kudos to them.
No more messages.
To give us your opinion on Sound Opinions, call our hotline, 1-888-859-1800. We'll be back next week with Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. La-ha!